Нашел он Мара Путин, just a young, he's out of style. But now I'm here to tell you, tell you presents have no now. Life's story, love and glory, if you listen, we're dependent for you to listen and listen and dig it. Can't you dig?
Comment on. So I will just go ahead and bring up the story, and we can just sort of let it pass around the group, and I'll go off chasing for Doc while everybody's talking about it. But the story I'd like to bring up first tonight is, of course, listed on our website. It is the story about Steve Ballmer, once again coming out after Linux and open source. He's back. I really don't, you know, we should never complain about Steve Ballmer. He really is probably one of the singularly most effective marketing tools to work on behalf of open source. It is hard, really hard to believe that this guy could really behave any worse and be obviously any more a person who seems to be ignorant of the fact, or at least possibly be schizophrenic enough to take relish in putting his foot in his mouth. I just don't understand it. But great article at InfoWorld talking about Ballmer's battle, renewed battle this week in his communications with the Munich government in Germany this past week. Russ, I got to give you original credit for sending me this link. Why don't you pick it up, and I'll go off chasing after Doc.
All righty. This is a great little story that you can find on the Linux Show webpage. But it's interesting. Steve Ballmer, for people who hadn't seen it, managed to fly off to Munich in Germany to convince them to stay the Microsoft course because he had gotten word of the fact that they are actually looking at non-Microsoft alternatives, and of course by that we know we mean Linux. It is it's rather amazing to me, though, that here you have the CEO of the largest software company on the planet who is now bound to make personal trips to all of these key government institutions which are looking elsewhere. I mean, he's going to get his share of frequent flyer miles, to be sure, I think, over the next year or so, if this is going to be the Microsoft policy. But there is a tremendous amount of pressure going on here, and it's very good to see from an open source standpoint, because it means that Microsoft is worried. No two ways about that. So it's good news from that standpoint. It's interesting otherwise that they are going to be playing run around. Let's see if we can keep the sheep in the fold, even though the fences are falling now. So it's going to be an interesting year in that regard.
What is the status of the Munich city of Munich? What are they doing?
Well, apparently they were going to be making a decision on whether to go to open source. And as a result of Mr. Ballmer's closed-door meeting, they have put off their decision until I believe it's the end of May.
Yes, that's correct.
So
when he's not there.
But or you know, waiting for the check to clear or whatever the heck it is that's going on there. But you know, it's like what happened in Peru and other places. Where they're trying to do these interventions, it seems, to try to keep the troops in line, or whatever the heck, however you want to look at it.
What is Ballmer going to do, this one city at a time?
Every
city or municipality starts realizing that that they're spending tax dollars on a fruitless upgrade path.
This isn't just a city. This is Munich. Okay.
Yeah, I know, but you know, there's lots of city sizes of Munich.
It's got nothing to do with the size of Munich. This is a national capital, high profile, a classic, you know, urban center of the world. Second only to Berlin, in all of Germany in terms of not only size, but it's leading, I guess, in industrial base. So it's the
Well, I understand that. I'm just saying how deep are they willing to go to stop this? Because it seems like we're getting a lot of movement of the open source free software into the government structure. And
I think for Germany it may be too late for them. With the national government already having thrown some very hefty support behind open source alternative, and really much like the legislation that we were talking about just the other week in terms of what's going on in Oregon and Texas, Germany has a established law in place where they want all federal agencies look at open source alternatives. They're not mandating it, but they want them to look at open source alternatives and grind the numbers. And once that's in place, if they really do have an established form where they have to put things to numbers, it's inevitable that the commoditization of computers and the operating systems is going to wear down on Microsoft over the course of the next couple of years. It's just going to happen. I mean, it's just going to happen. So I think it's just too late for Germany. Also, this is a side issue, but unfortunately, Russ, I don't think even Baumer's going to get frequent flyer miles out of this, because if I understand this correctly, Baumer does have a private Microsoft jet.
Well, you know, the other thing that occurs to me is that they may just luck out, because with the airlines in such bad shape as they are, he can probably pick up an entire airline for a song at this point, which he's going to need, I think, in the next year or so.
Yeah, he's going to be battling this one city at a time.
Yeah, and quite frankly, I think before long they're going to have to use just more than Steve Ballmer, because I got a feeling that there's going to be an awful lot of this going on all over the place. And they're going to have to expand their roadshow. So they may have to buy United or one of these airlines that's having a less than stellar time of it.
Well, wouldn't be the first time something crazy like that was happened. Bill Gates did offer the Soviet Union, or I should say the former Soviet Union, several billion dollars for their ICBM fleet so that he could launch his own low orbit satellite network into orbit, but that never went through. But at least the presence is there. Bill Gates is crazy enough to do anything, I think, at this point. But the ball is already in your court, Russ. So why don't you go ahead and take it? I did hear Doc chime in back there.
Yeah, I'm here.
You should stop and just say hi to Doc. How you doing, Doc?
I'm doing fine. I'm sorry. I got in a little late because I just screwed up on the clock. It's too light, you know. So I got thrown off.
Isn't it nice though?
It's great. It's wonderful.
Gotta love daylight savings time.
It's wonderful, especially here where it's like 90 degrees now. It must be really hot where Arnie is, but it's right here.
It's warm.
Warm. Yeah.
My Netwinder went into high speed fan mode. That's the measure.
Well, Russ, why don't you go ahead and just continue with another story?
All righty. Well, the next one I have here is once again on our page, called In the Linux Loop over at Computer World, and it's a very interesting story, not for the details of companies using open source, but the fact that you have some very large corporations like Merrill Lynch, which not only are using open source, but they get it. And they get it down to the point of making policy on how they're going to participate in the process. And this is the really big story in all of this, as far as I'm concerned. That when companies begin to understand that it's in their to their benefit to participate actively in open source and not just be consumers, then really interesting things can start to happen. And then even more, I believe Mr. Baumer is going to need that that fleet of airplanes and assistance, because he's not going to be able to keep up with this. There's a lot of interesting things in here. And when Merrill Lynch and others like them decide that the whole process makes sense, others are going to start listening.
Yeah,
this is one of my
without the bad license.
This is one of my stories too this week, and I've got it printed off right in front of me, and they have a picture of Robert Lefkowitz, who is the director of open source strategy at Merrill Lynch, on the top of the article. And these guys are doing an IBM. They're basically saying, okay, we're going to take and contribute back to the community what we develop, and they understand it from the very, very core of their policies. And it's interesting that Merrill Lynch and the banking industry seems to be coming along very well in adopting open source free software, because basically their software is substantially custom software. And bankers and financial is technical, and they can use the help, and they realize that lots more minds working on the problem is better than just a few in house, and so they can leverage the community to get their problem solved faster and more economically.
Yeah.
And I think that's where this is going.
Couldn't you say in a lot of ways though that the big financial houses have really been on board for a long time, because they are essentially old Unix companies that have probably been using shared Unix code for a couple of decades. And, not 100%, of course. There's a lot of proprietary stuff in the banking industry, but there's a surprising amount of shared code used by financial institutions as well.
I mean, banking is banking.
Banking. Why should everybody develop this, their own floating point error program that would create a nightmare for the federal bank to regulate, whose floating point calculation should we use as a standard? And so a lot of that stuff has been shared literally for decades. Over in the hardcore Unix community.
Well, they've also the mainframe community too. And financial institutions have been using mainframes heavily and still do.
Yep. And we'll continue to forever, because they need them.
Yep.
Yep. Big numbers. But in a way, Doc, doesn't this sort of the story of In the Linux Loop, doesn't this sort of follow the same thread of some of the things that you're just now starting to work on?
Yeah, well, I've been working on it actually the last 4 months. It's interesting. There's a piece that ran in the Wall Street Journal on March 31st that the first time I looked at it, it was by William Bulkley, who's like one of their main writers, has been for a long time. And the whole technology section of the Wall Street Journal was all about open source and Wi-Fi and all these hot new things that are going on. And the opening line of his piece was, "Free software is going mainstream." And then he goes on, I'll just read you one paragraph. I'll tell you why in a second. "Open source software developed outside the corporate framework and available at no cost to anyone who wants to download it has long been considered by some to be somewhat untrustworthy or inadequate, but that perception is giving way to an appreciation of the improving quality and increasing versatility." The interesting thing is that there's a pattern here, and there's also a piece in today's Wall Street Journal. The front page of the marketplace section has a big feature on Larry Ellison, who apparently briefed the Wall Street Journal on how Silicon Valley is going to hell because of Linux. And it's going to put a lot of companies out of business because they're not going to be resourceful enough to cope with lower costs and margins being driven down and so forth and so on. And he says it's all about its old industrial principles that are involved, and it's a kind of a big vendor, winner-take-all sort of piece. And it goes unchallenged. It's in a similar way as some other assumptions go unchallenged in that first piece I quoted. Because all of these stories especially in the mainstream press, come from an assumption that nothing good happens unless a big vendor does it. And there's been a preponderance for a long time of perspective on the enterprise, what's happening in the enterprise, from the one side of the enterprise that faces vendors. In other words, the entire perspective is always like, what can be sold into here? You know, there's another line from that first piece, you know, with the profit motive driving its promotion, free software is cropping up all over corporate and government computers. As if only, you know, this is only because of vendors, and it completely ignores the resourcefulness of what's going on inside these organizations, where very often no vendor is involved at all. And I've just got a pile of emails here from people working on the inside of really huge companies saying, basically, we're not dealing with any vendors unless we absolutely have to. And there's guys like Elliot Noss, who with Two Cows, I may have quoted him a couple of weeks ago when I was at PC Forum, who said, my IT budget is zero. It doesn't come in at zero, but basically it's zero. That's the story with Merrill Lynch as well. And with Goldman Sachs, which wrote a piece called, a big paper called Fear the Penguin a few months back. And the point in every case, and it's not one talked about a lot, and it's the one that I'm looking at, and this Merrill Lynch piece definitely does dovetail with it a great deal, has to do with the resourcefulness of people working inside companies. And some of that resourcefulness goes back, as it does with Merrill Lynch, to the open source development community, but it's very much on the model of, as I harp on so often, the construction industry, where there really are no secrets about how to pour concrete or how to put up sheetrock or how to hang a door, even though the art does change over the course of a number of years. And that lack of secrecy and the value that comes from not being secretive and not being proprietary is part of the selling point, power. Are we all still here?
Yep.
Okay. There's all kinds of weird sounds going on the line, and I thought, oh, well, I'm being popped off here.
That's the Department of Homeland Security.
<I'm
gonna visit.
laughs> holding those alligator clips to the line.
Yeah,
trying to count the packets. Who knows? Anyway, it's really about DIY. It's about do it yourself. There's a huge do it yourself ethic that goes on that has not been getting much respect, and so that's sort of what I'm in the throes of finally finishing up a piece for July in Linux Journal about that.
I'm intrigued by that one, Doc.
Yeah.
Now, that's a great subject. Companies putting together their own computers with their own operating systems and utilizing free software. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Well, it's not just exactly. I mean, they're buying cheaper. They're buying cheap hardware, or they're leveraging their already purchased hardware.
This is the kind of stuff that comes in under the radar of the marketing surveys.
Oh, totally. I mean, here's a piece from I got an email from a guy at Orbitz. Orbitz is one of the big travel
cheap ticket house.
Huh?
Cheap ticket.
A cheap ticket house, right? Well, you know, I mean, just read a little bit of this one line here, one email I got from this guy. We leverage open source projects in the production environment, and we're not afraid to be public about it. We currently use around 750 Linux machines. Our web servers are Apache running on Linux. Our application servers are servlet engines running on Linux. Our back-end booking engine is comprised entirely of Java services running on Linux. Software that does the low-fare searching that is one of the key differentiators from us and our rivals is also running on Linux. The move to Linux on the application server layer was accomplished early this year. We were able to replace 12 Sun E4500 machines with 12 processors with 50 dual processor Intel machines. But you know, he goes on to talk about the ways they came around to doing this kind of thing. And it all has to do with avoiding contact with vendors as much as possible. You know, and that's all due respect. I mean, there was a guy, I forget his name now, who is a top IT guy at Amazon, who said that they're very close to Oracle. They love Oracle. They're getting along very fine with Oracle. I'll bet you, though, that if MySQL ever begins to equal what you can do with Oracle, he said there are certain things you can only do with Oracle. it's going to be a matter of time for Oracle as well.
Well, I don't think it's going to be MySQL. I think it's going to be PostgreSQL.
Postgres, yeah.
That'll probably hit that level first.
Right. Well, that's possible, too.
They're both pretty good, though.
And they're both getting a lot of precedent. The thing with MySQL is that they have an interesting animal here in that they have open source free software, essentially GPL free software that they happen to own, you know, they give it away and they also sell it. And but because they own it, they're able to sell it to those people who are afraid of the GPL. And that's a major selling point for them with a bank or something like that. It's kind of an interesting angle that they have there. And people contribute to it because they are willing to give it away for free. And yet it still manages to be GPL.
Yep. Now, let's take a look at Ellison's comments, though. I don't totally disagree with him about this what the potential of the DYI effort.
I don't utterly either. I think that it's spun in a little bit of a dark way.
I think that he's, and I could be wrong because this is such a new thing, but I think it's more likely to spawn the opposite reaction than what he is predicting. He's predicting, you know, dire consequences for Silicon Valley, that they're going to end up being, one or two vendors, MIC computer, MIC operating system, MIC word processor, you know, type of ultimate commoditization path where you've got one or two extremely strong vendors. But I'm looking at this as just almost 180 degrees out from what he's saying, is that I think that this kind of an environment where you've got big companies who are not interested in dealing with the big vendors anymore because they've been burned so many times are far more likely to go to micro-niche players.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? And the reason why I say this is because I'm in the middle of seeing this happen in the Chicago market right now, where people over the course of the last 2 years have been laid off right and left in big engineering companies, and yet right now is the golden age of outsourcing in the Chicago marketplace.
Right.
If you have got a very narrow skill set, and you can do that very narrow skill set extremely cost effective, you right now you can get more work than you can possibly handle right now.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people I'm talking to around here are calling it micro niches. It's because, you know, all these engineers are, you know, developing their own little specialties and hanging up shingles. And so I think Ellison's wrong.
And there's another side to that, Jeff. Also, you can look at the other side of that coin. The micro niche is important, but a person versed in Linux, Linux operates on palm tops to mainframes, to superclusters.
More niches.
And you know, someone with a Linux skill set is useful in many niches.
Well,
generally.
That's right.
Especially a developer who's versed in Linux.
Absolutely. Well, wow, it's already 8:30. Doc, do you have any more stories?
No, not really. I think, I mean, there are more that are sort of along that same line, but
yeah.
That's okay.
Well,
I think we can...
I think we're going to be talking about this for probably the next 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
This is a pretty new, interesting trend that has popped up.
Computer World also has another story I just might add on the same topic. I can put the link up on IRC. It's a reporter's notebook, Linux gaining interest from Wall Street, and that dovetails neatly with Russ's and my link for this week on Merrill Lynch, and kind of interesting read from Computer World.
Okay. Kevin, do you have any new product releases this week?
Oh, yeah. Red Hat 9 is out to the world now and installed on my laptop. Everything worked. a lot like 8, at least in outward appearance. It's got the newer evolution, which fixes a couple things that needed fixing, and the menus are laid out a fair bit more logically than they were previously. And I'll get a more in-depth review once I get a chance to play with it some more.
And so the compatibility issues that were popping up about a week and a half ago are not playing out to be as disastrous as people thought they were?
Well, it's too early to tell. I still haven't tried it on my machine with the NVIDIA card, but so far I haven't run across anything major yet.
Yeah, okay. All right. Russ, do you have any more stories of the week?
Yeah, let me just hit a few real quick. One is that there's an announcement that SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop has been delayed and is coming out, I guess it's in the second quarter. It's interesting in that, of course, people are obviously realizing that it's important to have that enterprise desktop entry, and we're seeing that over and over again. Some people I saw on Linux Today discussing this were saying, well, they're using a per-seat licensing, and that's true, but they're also including things like, I think, the CodeWeavers stuff and some other proprietary things in there as well, which is how they're dealing with this per-seat licensing. The second thing is that Duke Nukem 3D, which you know has been around for a while, was released in the source code was released, and within like 2 days, someone managed to get the Linux port working. It's limping quite a bit from what I've seen, but it is indeed functional, and there's still more work being done on that. So I found that just interesting, but also once again, the power to be able to port that stuff in days rather than months or years is pretty amazing.
What was the original platform for Duke Nukem?
I think originally it was a DOS game. 3D.
DOS to Linux in a couple days.
Yeah. There's still got more to do on it, but apparently you can play it. And then the last one, and I know that Arnie, you have a clueless pundit of the week, and I've got one too. And this one comes is called "As Good as It Gets for Linux" over at OS Opinion, and it has an April 1 date on it. But I've never seen anyone say that this is an April Fool's joke, but for crying out loud, it strikes me like one, because this could have been written in 1999.
It could have been written in 1998.
Yeah, the thesis point is to cross the chasm, an OS needs a big marketing machine behind it, Linux doesn't have one, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, stuff only goes so far. That is precisely the stuff that we were reading at the end of the 90s about why Linux couldn't possibly succeed. And you know what? They're wrong. And quite frankly, you know, I read this one over, and it is no more right than its predecessors were, as far as I'm concerned. It's just not there.
I'm looking at it. It's I read it earlier today. It's completely and totally lame. And I mean, this guy totally ignores IBM, totally ignores Red Hat success, totally ignores virtually all the information. He's claiming that Linux will be a nice niche operating system for the desktop, but there just isn't enough capital out there for independent software that might consider developing desktop applications based on Linux. I mean, you mean other than Sun Office?
beware, guys, because it does have an April 1st date on it.
Yeah, well, so. This guy's clueless.
But I never saw anything, and I looked around. I really did look around to see if anyone said, "Aha, we gotcha," but no one has.
Yeah, no. When you sent me the link, Russ, I tried to email the guy, and I have yet have gotten no response. So I'm just being cautious. In saying, you know, it's got an April 1st date on it. That's all I'm saying.
Yep.
So be wary.
I have one, too.
Okay.
eWeek sent me a nice letter this week, email by email, and inviting me to go see their digital content. And they're raving about a bunch of stuff. This is signed by Eric Lundquist, who's the editor-in-chief over there. And I went to go. I said, that's interesting. I can not have the dead tree version if I can get the same thing. Are we still on?
Yeah.
Okay. And what I go to the site, and apparently they're using a client which is proprietary and, of course, will not work under Linux. So, and then I go research this a little further, and apparently eWeek isn't the only people using this. Zinio Systems is also being used by InfoWorld and PC World and Network World and Design News and SQL Server and a variety of other periodicals. And one of the things I found out is that this is a technology partner. The Zinio is a technology partner with Microsoft to challenge the PDF format. And which this is totally clueless. I mean, who we have is trying to lock down a proprietary channel. Okay, PDF is proprietary as well, but at least there's support for it everywhere. And of course, you know, this sounds, leaves a bad taste in my mouth with Microsoft's name on it.
Yep.
So clueless eWeek, start using a portable format that we can all use if you're going to be part of the industry. Also, InfoWorld.
I do want to bring up one real quick story that the URL has already flashed through the IRC a couple of times. It's a new story at NewsForge by Linux Show extremely loyal listener, NZ Heretic, Dave.
Good morning.
Yeah, Dave.
From
Moore,
New Zealand.
From New Zealand. The article is entitled More Secure Than Microsoft, and I'll leave it up to Dave to drop the URL back on the IRC one more time, and I will add the URL to our website after the show tonight. It's a great article. Dave gave it to me just at the beginning of the show, and I had a couple of minutes to read through it. Once again, a real good piece by Dave, and illustrates step-by-step the security issues that Microsoft has utterly failed at and have it completely ignored with their own fear and doubt security campaign against Linux and open source products. So it's a real good read. Good job, Dave. So why don't we take a couple minutes break? It is 38 minutes after the hour, so we are running a few minutes behind schedule. So we'll take a break. We'll come back in about 3 or 4 minutes with our guests, and we'll be talking about that amazing movie, documentary, and Revolution OS. And we'll be back in 3 or 4 minutes. Everybody hang in there, listen to the tune. I don't know what Kevin's going to put on. Listen to everybody who's been emailing me. If you've got a request, please email staff@thelinuxshow.com. Or if you've got a band that you want to suggest that will produce open source music, again, email staff@linuxshow.com, and Kevin will get them to the loop of our song library. So take it away, Kevin. Put a tune on. Let's get out of here. Come back in 3 or 4 minutes with the second half of the Linux Show for April 8th, 2003.
While tearing off a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy. But when I do, I don't follow through, because my heart belongs to daddy. If I invite a guy from night to dine out to Fireton and Hattie, I do sit down, he's asking for more, but my heart belongs to daddy. My heart belongs to daddy. Simply could it be bad? And my heart belongs to daddy. Dad, 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 dad. My daddy, he treats us so well. so well.
Okay, we're out. Back.
This is the Linux Show for April the 8th, 2003, segment number two. Before we jump in, we're going to do a little bit of housekeeping, keep you folks informed of what's going on with the Linux Show. Once again, we want to thank all of those people who have been so gracious at supporting us over the last couple of weeks. We want to address your attention to our website, www.thelinuxshow.com. You will see on our website a handful of links, one of them to our registration service partner. You can go get yourself a domain name registered cheap, something like $7. There's a special going on right now of .us. If I understand this correctly, if you get a .us and a .biz at the same time, you get them for like $15 or something like that. It's really very cheap. But we get a couple bucks out of that. We also have a PayPal link there where you can actually be a sponsor of the Linux Show and follow in the footsteps of such amazing listeners like Stock, who underwrote the entire month of March. What a gracious guy. Stock's a listener from, where is it? It's like Norway. Or Sweden, or somewhere up there in the northern climes. But again, thanks to Stock for being sponsor of the month of March. We really appreciate it here at the Linux Show. It's tough to pay the bills here doing a show that's basically a non-for-profit type of a show, promoting the comings and goings of Linux and open source. One other housekeeping item. Last week on the show, we said within 48 hours, we were going to be making a special announcement, and I directed people to sign up to our email list. I'd like to thank all the people who did sign up for the email list, but then turn around and apologize. There's still a couple of legal issues that hung us up from making that announcement, and supposedly that announcement will be made Thursday of this week. Again, I can't tell you too much about what it is. It's got something to do with GeekPack and a fundraising thing dealing with ISPs, but I can't go much further beyond that until the legal issues are addressed. But again, tell your friends and have them tell friends to go sign up to the email list of the Linux Show so that they can be notified about this special announcement coming out in a couple of days. It is hot, heavy, important news, especially if you love the freedom of the Internet. If you don't give a damn about the Internet and you think it's a really wonderful idea that the phone companies and the cable companies are going to be allowed to steal the Internet away from you, then, you know, don't go sign up for that list and don't pay any attention to what's going on around you. Feel free to continue to live in oblivion and wake up one day with the Internet becoming a digital rights managed delivery network. Enough lecturing. Let's go on to segment number two of the Linux Show. I'm going to turn it on over to Russ. We're going to be talking about the movie industry and some cool new things, a gamble, to say the least, being taken with the distribution of a DVD about to be released. So, Russ, take it away.
All righty. Tonight we are very happy to welcome JTS Moore to the Linux Show. How are you doing?
Very well, Russ.
All righty. JTS Moore, for people may recognize the name, is one of the creators, or is the creator, of Revolution OS, which is a very interesting film. And since we're working on a little time delay here with IRC, I just ask anyone who happens to be in IRC who has seen the film, just to kind of say yo, and we'll try to get a running count as we go here, just to see who has seen the film.
Oh, that's great to find out.
All right, and for the benefit of the folks who haven't seen the film, can you?
I've seen it six times.
Jeff's up there, that's for sure.
That's fantastic.
For the benefit of the folks who haven't seen it, can you give us an idea of what this film is about?
Well, basically, Revolution OS is a feature-length documentary film about the people behind the creation of GNU, Linux, free software, and the open source movement. So the film stars Linus Torvalds and Richard Stallman and features Eric Raymond and Bruce Perens and Brian Bellendorf and Larry Augustin and Michael Tiemann, and there's a whole list of guys in there. And the whole kind of take of the film is not to tell you what's going on with Linux in 2003, but to tell you why Linux and GNU and open source came into existence and those that first kind of critical 15 years or so. And from the point of view of what's the story and like who were the people involved and what were their ideas and what were their motivations. And so that was kind of the take I had on the film.
All right. Now, this has been out for a while. When did you actually put out the film originally?
Well, the film, this is indicative of the world of independent film and independent documentary especially. It takes a long time for it to make its way through the whole process. The film had a sneak preview way back in February 2001 at Linux World. Then it had its festival debut at South by Southwest in March 2001. And then at the end of 2001, after screening at film festivals and conventions around the country, it was acquired by a art house theatrical distributor here in Los Angeles named Seventh Art Releasing. And then they did a small art house theatrical release for the film in 2002, and that included playing in New York City for a couple of weeks, then playing in Los Angeles and in Austin, Texas. The guys, the crowd in Austin was fantastic. I mean, they've got a great, you know, the combination of their film-going crowd down there and their Linux scene and whatnot. We had fantastic turnout in Austin. And then played San Jose and Portland and Seattle and Edmonton, Canada. And then also Sundance Channel licensed the U.S. TV rights, and it's since been licensed to, I think, the Documentary Channel in Canada. I believe the Australian Broadcasting Company down in Australia, and I think a channel in Japan. And then I did a promotion with Hewlett-Packard at the end of last year, and that was the first way that people kind of got their hands on the DVD. But the first time it's actually been for sale that anyone could buy it, it was just the past week or so when it went on sale on ThinkGeek.
Mm.
And the version that's on sale is like the nice special edition version, a great transfer of the picture and the audio. We have 70 minutes of additional interview footage with Linus Torvalds and Richard Stallman and Brian Bellendorf from Bruce Perens, and then there are all sorts of additional bonus features on top of that.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, I spent months personally working on the special edition because I really wanted to give kind of people something to sink their teeth into.
When did you actually start this project?
Started the film
right
in July of 1999.
Okay, now July of 1999, you know, I'm thinking back to that. At that point in time, open source as a whole was struggling to get attention from anyone who happened to be not a geek.
That's right.
And now, how is it that you came into the position of saying, not only, you know, I will learn about this, but I will learn about this and I will actually spend my time, my money, and everything else to put together a film about all this?
Well, basically, just to back up a little bit before that, I'd been working as a screenwriter in L.A. I worked as a screenwriter for Disney, and then I'd written what are called several spec screenplays, which are screenplays you write and then you try and sell later, and then, you know, doing the whole kind of typical Hollywood screenwriter thing. But I very much wanted to get back behind the camera and make another film. And so I'd been thinking about doing a documentary because I thought, well, that's the cheapest way I can actually go out and make a film. And then coincidentally, a friend of mine from Stanford University named Douglas Bone, one day I was on the phone with him in 1999, and he jokingly suggested, you ought to make a film about the history of Linux. And my first thought, because I knew next to nothing about it, my first thought was, that is really dry. But then I thought, wait a second. What would the, you know, because I didn't want to dismiss the idea out of hand. You never know where you're going to get a good idea, right? And so I said, well, what would the story be? And then he started to tell me. And I thought, wait a second, this is actually something really interesting. I mean, I'm not, I don't write software, but there's something to it beyond that. And the implications of it in terms of open source and the implications of Linux going forward in the software and computer industry, but also the story of, you know, Richard Stallman kind of starting out with his vision of free software, and then how Linux came in and created the kernel, and then how it slowly built up as this kind of grassroots movement around the world, and then the counterintuitive idea at which where people are trying to start up companies based upon selling a free product. It's all very interesting. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, this is something worth checking out. And then I researched it, and I found no one had made a film about this. And at the time, no one had even really written any books about this. This is right around the time, I think, that O'Reilly and Associates published their Open Sources book. Beyond that collection of articles, there were no histories about, you know, Linux and open source and GNU written. So it was really kind of a fresh field to move into. And so I came up to Silicon Valley and started researching it and interviewing people. And the thing that finally hooked me in was just the absolute passion that people had for this, had for open source, had for Linux, and had for GNU. And I thought, there's got to be something here. I mean, I was meeting people that were more passionate about that than just about anything I'd encountered in quite some time. And so I decided very quickly that if I was going to do it, it seemed like now was the time to start the film. And so I immediately just kind of jumped into it. And I was basically researching the film as I was making it. Because again, there wasn't a lot, aside from articles or things such as Eric Raymond's Cathedral and the Bazaar, people's personal philosophical writings, there wasn't a lot about it. So literally, I would interview someone, and I would say, well, who else should I talk to? And then I'd, you know, use that person's interview and their suggestions and go talk to someone else, and just kind of literally was first-person research, as we say, and just built it that way.
It is fascinating to watch, and I happen to have a copy of that that HP limited run that was done.
Yeah, HP. I got to tell you, the people at HP have been fantastic supporters of the film. They basically kept me alive for the past year and a half. So,
amen.
I'm incredibly grateful to you know how they've been. You know, I know HP's got a little bit of a you know culture clash there between kind of the Windows Microsoft camp and the Linux camp, but the people you know in HP's open source Linux business development operation are just great people.
Well, that's cool. But I'll tell you, having lived through this, you know, I started personally using Linux in 95, and I started to get involved in the community to some degree in 97. The thing that astounds me about this, looking back, is that rather than a documentary that's after the fact, and we see a lot of those sorts of things where you have the interviews with the stately gentleman sitting inside his armchair there inside the CEO's office, wearing a suit probably that costs more than my car. This is a series of interviews in progress. I mean, back there in 99, the struggle was on. There was nothing. There were no foregone conclusions about where open source was going at the time that you made this film. There was a lot of hope and there was a lot of drive, but there was no impressive list of victories or anything like this at the time. And it is absolutely fascinating to see this in progress, and especially for people who may have only begun to become aware of open source in the last couple of years. I think it's a terrific vehicle to try to get a feel of where all this came from. And the other thing that I would just mention too, as you were talking, you said you were concerned about it being dry. One of the things that I became quickly aware of in the late 90s is that open source does not lack for personalities.
That's exactly right. And that was one of the great delights of the film. And was that you'd meet, you know, very fascinating people. I mean, you know, Richard Stallman is a idiosyncratic, interesting, compelling individual. And, I know he cuts a controversial path through the, you know, worlds of free software and open source, but you gotta give him his credit, and you gotta, you know, and I really, that was one of the things, that was kind of the revelation for me making the film, which is obviously I was starting out from the point of view, I'd heard of Linux only slightly. And my friend jokingly suggested do a film about the history of Linux. But as I researched it, to me the bigger story was not just starting in August of 1991 with Linus Torvalds in Helsinki, Finland. It's the bigger picture of where the ideas and the fundamental, you know, political, legal architecture of all this came from. And that's where you really got the story, which is Richard Stallman's story, and then how that intersects with Linus. And that I thought was really, that's, you know, really, I think, helped give the film a sense of structure and direction. Because that was one of the tricky things about making the film, which is you can make a documentary about a kind of a culture such as open source, and you can basically have segments. It can be like, well, this is the, you know, this is what the kind of the hackers that like techno music, and this is the hackers that code, you know, here in Silicon Valley, and this is what they do in their off hours, and this is what they do for recreation, and this is kind of, and you end up with, kind of think of it as a wheel with several spokes coming off of it. My kind of bias, so to speak, artistically or creatively, is I like three-act structures. I'm coming very much out of a Hollywood background. I mean, after going to Stanford, I went to USC Film School, and that's very much what I like, and that's what I was trained to do. And so my approach was to figure out, well, what's the story? Who are the lead characters? Who are the antagonists? What's the conflict? What's the beginning, middle, and end? Now, I know the story of open source and Linux and GNU is ongoing. So, but one of the tricky things about film is it has to come to an end whether you want it to or not at some point. So the decision for me was to really not make the film about a bunch of little segments about the culture of open source, but to make the film about the story of its origins and the people behind it. And I know I'll get emails from people saying, well, why didn't you talk about, you know, this, you know, something that happened in 1990, year 2000 or year 2001. It's because I felt like, there's a first phase, a kind of epoch of history of the movement, and it really kind of ends right around 2000. And then, because what you have going forward after the year 2000 is basically you have IBM and Hewlett Packard becoming involved, and Linux and open source become very mainstream. But that's a different story. The story that I think really needed to be preserved is, where did it come from? Who are the people involved, and why did they do it? And what were their personal struggles?
Yeah, and in that regard, it's absolutely fascinating. Now, let's shift gears just a little bit and let's talk about the release of the DVD.
Okay.
Now, you did something very bold and unusual and decidedly un-Hollywood-like with the release of this DVD, and that is that you are not using the CSS encryption.
That's right. There's no Macrovision or CSS encryption on the film, and it's region-free. It's not a decision that I came to early on or very easily. I actually made the film myself and I own it, and the only way I make money is to make money off the film until I go out for a job next month. So basically, you know, I'm obviously very concerned about people copying it and me not being compensated for it. That said, early on, once I started doing question and answer sessions at film festivals and getting emails back from people, one of the early issues raised was about the whole CSS encryption that's standard on most Hollywood studio DVDs. And the basic issue is that most Linux-based DVD drives cannot legally decrypt the CSS encryption because they're open source and CSS encryption is not, and you get all these issues. And I thought, well, that's an interesting little conundrum I'm facing. But I thought I'd kind of cross that bridge when I came to it. And I kept coming back to the concern about, you know, piracy. And well, that's been one of my concerns all along about the open source movement. The movement, in one sense, I don't have a dog in the fight. I mean, you know, I made a film about it. I'm depicting it. But, you know, I'm not necessarily an advocate for Linux or GNU over another operating system, though I'm very sympathetic, obviously. But to me, one of the critical issues for the open source movement going forward was that it not get associated with the idea of intellectual property piracy. That open source, I think, the reason it works and the reason it will succeed is if it's about choice, if it's about people choosing to participate. If it simply becomes a rationale after the fact for people to take other people's creative works, then it's going to completely taint the movement. It's never going to work. And that was my concern all along. At the same time, I was open to discussion about kind of what I was doing with the film. And so I kept getting more and more requests to go CSS free, and I kept thinking about, well, what's the trade-off? You know, obviously I have a very specific target audience for the film, which is primarily people that are involved with GNU and Linux, and I wanted to, you know, be, you know, aware of that and work with that. And then finally, I I read a book by Lawrence Lessig called The Future of Ideas. And originally I thought, you know, from what I'd read of Larry Lessig, that he was maybe this kind of wild man of intellectual property and, you know, so on and so forth. But right around the time of the case he argued before the Supreme Court, the Eldred versus Ashcroft case regarding the extension of copyrights, I started reading more and more about him and getting a sense of kind of where he was really coming from. And I read his book, and I thought, you know, a lot of what he's saying makes sense, because there's a real danger here with copyright law. I mean, believe me, I'm all for a strong copyright. That's the only thing that's keeping me afloat. But I'm also recognized that we don't exist in creative vacuums. We are influenced by things that have preceded us and that are around us currently. And you can't make a documentary in a vacuum, because, you know, you're discussing, say, Microsoft, or you're filming at a trade show or whatnot. And so there's got to be a reasonable sense of fair use. And so that just, you know, practical recognition on my part, and also the concerns about the community, and also just the general concern about the direction of digital rights management, which I think, you know, during the break you were making a comment about the danger of the Internet becoming basically this kind of digital rights management delivery system and not really this free and open frontier that we've had. And those issues kind of got all pulled together with Lessig's book, and it was very compelling. And wherever the money to make it, I'd love to make a documentary based upon his book, because there's a lot there to really think about and that you could put in a film. And so after talking with him and talking with Eric Raymond and a few other people, Bruce Behrens, and ended up exchanging emails last year with Richard Stallman about this, I decided, you know what, I'm just going to go for it and see what will happen.
Mm-hmm. I honestly don't think you're going to have as much of a problem as some people may think, and I think some people may hope you will have.
I think you're right, and I think that's, and I think it'll be, and I think that, you know, hopefully if the DVD sells well enough, it'll be a valuable lesson, which is basically, if you buy a piece of property, as long as you don't act in a way to prevent someone else from making, you know, the copywriter from making additional sales, it's your kind of piece of property, and if you need to make a backup copy of it and do it so on and so forth, it really shouldn't be somebody remotely 20 years down the road controlling that. And that's what that was the thing that really bugged me, was this sense of loss of freedom, even, you know. So.
Yeah, well, it really goes further beyond that, because the majority of the piracy that is going on today is as much of a behavioral issue of teenagers.
Yeah, I agree.
It's really not the hacker community, the development community, as much as the RIA would like to point the finger.
It is, though I will give the MPA and RIA, I will agree with them. It is a real problem, because if you basically grow up a culture of teenagers that basically think that their movies and music should be free, they're going to cut their nose off to spite their face, because eventually there will be no economic rationale to do it. And the point is, they're not going out and pirating, for the most part, the little band or the small independent film that needs the exposure. They're pirating, you know, top 40 hits and Lord of the Rings. And so,
yeah,
I
completely agree with you. But in defense of these teenagers, we really have, ironically, much less of a problem with the motion picture industry, with your industry group, than the recording industry group. Because let's look at your documentary. This documentary had to cost an enormous amount of money to produce. It just had to. And likewise, most of the movies that are being put out today cost millions and millions and millions of dollars, and yet you can walk into Blockbuster or one of these other DVD video rental places and pick up a copy of the DVD for $10.
Mm-hmm.
That is not an unreasonable amount of money to ask.
Mm-hmm.
For a product that may have taken $50 or $100 million to develop.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very reasonable price for the motion picture industry to be asking. On the other hand, you've got the recording industry, where it takes them next to nothing to produce a record. It costs them 33 cents to produce a CD, and they want 1675. And
the challenge always comes back to that great burden that we all have to carry, which is the marketing expense.
Marketing and lawyers.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Those two things. I mean, I think literally the whole economy exists just to service the marketing and legal business.
Well, that's right. And the teenagers, frankly, don't give a damn about marketing. And that's
but the only way they know about this stuff is because somebody pours a ton of money into marketing for the most part.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. But, you know, regardless, I don't think you're going to have the problem that a lot of people are probably anticipating you might. I would want to make a suggestion to you
mm-hmm.
that you may want to come up with a mechanism by which people who want to buy the movie in volume and give it away to people can do it legally without having to pay full price for every single copy. Now, give people a discount for providing you with volume business.
Oh, I'm happy to do bulk sales. I mean,
yeah.
if anyone's interested in bulk sales, they just go to the revolution-os.com website, and there's a link to email me. I'm happy to talk with them about that. And that does save a bundle on shipping.
Because I know for one, myself, I would love to give about 25 copies of that away to people.
Well, email me after the show. We'll cut you a deal.
What's the cost if someone wants to purchase this?
Right now, on ThinkGeek, the retail price is $24.99 plus shipping.
That's typical.
That's pretty standard. You know, for a double disc DVD, that's fairly.
That's two discs.
Two discs, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and you know, if you want to buy in bulk or whatnot, email me and I can knock that down and you know, ship it all at once. That saves a lot of money. So.
There is a question coming out of the IRC room.
Okay.
And I don't know if I forewarned you that we have a kind of an active IRC out there. So
I gathered from what you were talking about.
And there's a question from Stock. How are sales going?
How are sales going? Sales for the other note about all this is I am self-distributing the DVD. So everything's relative, but we sold out of our first run at the end of last week, and actually we're waiting for another order to come through so ThinkGeek can put them back on sale. So that's good.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very cool. And let me just throw in a personal note here, too, to people who are listening. I think it's a tremendous film, and I think it's tremendous what you are doing as far as the distribution of it. And I really do encourage people to go out and get a copy and either share it with your friends as far as, you know, letting them see it or as a gift or whatever. But I think it's important that we applaud the job that's being done and also send the message to Hollywood that, you know, we're not out here to steal other people's works. But frankly, a lot of the brouhaha over... DECSS, a lot of it's artificial because, you know, quite frankly, a lot of the theft and stuff like this that's going on has nothing to do with the CSS algorithm or the DECSS algorithm that has been inside the public eye for so long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember seeing something just a few months ago about how before Lord of the Rings Two Towers actually went into theatrical distribution, you could buy copies on the street corners in Hong Kong.
Yeah, it's a combination of particularly around Oscar season, studios send out a lot of screener tapes and screener DVDs, and that's partially what's feeding the whole problem. And then, you know, there are just people in the studios that sometimes take a little copy home with them and illegally go out and decide to go in their own distribution business.
Yeah.
So you're right, it has nothing to do with the DCSS issue because it's happening before that even gets really factored into it.
Yeah, but I think it's important, too, that people who are interested support something like this because maybe, just maybe, someone will actually wake up and smell the coffee.
And it's a concern because, I mean, I've been reading about, I mean, first, you know, there's the whole USITA issue that Stallman talks about. And then there's also the issue, the attempts by the studios and their RIA to to basically, you know, do their own state-level versions of the DMCA, which is a little concerned if you're just getting this redundant layer of thicket of pseudo-copyright law that's all about digital rights management. It's troubling because, you know, for the most part, you know, I doubt that a lot of the legislators are really thinking through all the various facets of it, you know. I mean, because it's, you know, in a lot of states, the kind of intellectual property business is not a bread and butter business. So it's kind of like, well, it's a reasonable argument when the studios and the record industry make it, but it's, you know, there's more to it than that. So that's and that's my concern, that the full picture is not being presented. It's not just about people being able to get stuff for free.
Some of the people on in the IRC channel have indicated that they are just even now purchasing the item from ThinkGeek.
Oh, really?
I'm going to go over the contents. Disc 1 contains the documentary, the audio commentary, theatrical trailers, music-only audio track. It's a letterbox picture in 2.35:1 ratio.
Mm-hmm.
It's got digital stereo surround sound and scene index menus. Disc 2 contains additional interviews, including 70 minutes with Linus Torvalds, Richard Stallman, Brian Bellendorf, Bruce Perens, and others. The free software song, music, video, and tell me you can get that anywhere. Still image
you
gallery.
Actually, that's one thing. You can download it for free on the revolutionos.com.
There you
website.
Go. But only available from the Revolution OS.
That's right.
Biographies, document files containing 113 pages of free software and open software writings. And it also is in letterboxed at 2.35:1 ratio, digital stereo sound, and interactive menus.
Still image gallery.
Well, right there,
yeah,
that
I got
makes
that.
It, that right makes it for me, because I don't buy movies unless they're letterboxed. So they got
yeah,
me.
The film was shot, I shot the film myself, and it was shot on 35, and it's shot in the CinemaScope format, which is extremely rare for documentaries.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful way to make a film.
Yeah, it was a lot of work, but it looks. I was very pleased. I mean, it was a fun experiment.
Well, that's what
Linux. What Linux World Expo did you film at?
I filmed it. The what I think is like the watershed one, really.
That,
the August 1999 Linux World Expo in San Jose. Right, it's that was the same week that Red Hat went public. It's the same, you know, it's the same week that at that expo that Linus and Richard were on stage together. I don't know if any, you know, that's a big part of the film. And it's just the buzz at that one, because that was really kind of where Linux was bursting out onto the public scene. That was a great thing to be a part of.
Is that the one that the Linux show broadcast live from?
Yeah, it sounds right.
Yes, we broadcast at that. That was one of the three.
That was a high point. That was a high point.
Yeah, well, you were in the Linux Journal booth that year.
Yes, and I was throwing rocks at Richard.
That's where I met you, Jeff.
Yeah, I was on the audience throwing rocks at Richard.
That was where Linus on stage said he hated Emacs.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the one where Richard gave Linus shit for the name of Linux.
Yeah, I've got that. That's in the film.
As he's being handed a $25,000 check.
That's exactly right, and that's in the film. It's a great moment.
Yeah, I've got that on video myself at home. But it's a well-made film, and that's probably the reason why I've watched it six times. I saw it once in a theatrical release in San Jose somewhere. Can't even remember where or when it was. I was out. San Jose for some reason, and it was when you were doing one of the theatrical special releases.
Mm-hmm.
I just happened to be there when it happened.
Well, thank you for coming down.
And I have also watched it on the Sundance Channel 5 times.
Wow.
And I've watched it on the Sundance Channel 5 times because it's a well-made movie. It's pleasurable to look at. It's a well-made movie. Now,
well,
I haven't said that. I do have a production question for you before we shut down for the evening. I know you said that a lot of the interview selection was first-person research, self-driven. You'd interview one guy and say, who do I interview next?
Mm-hmm.
But I found something ironic. Maybe it isn't ironic. I just found something unusual about the fact that every significant interview was, RMS was his butt in a chair, Linus was his butt in a chair, Eric with his butt in a chair, Larry Augustin with his butt in a chair, all by themselves, with no groups of people. Did you consciously have them alone?
That's just really a lot of things in film are influenced by practical considerations, which was just basically it took a year to basically, you know, because I couldn't afford to fly around the world to track people down. So basically, I would try and catch people as they were coming in and out of Silicon Valley, or if they were suddenly available. And so it was basically whenever I could get them, I got them. So basically, no one was really at the same place at the same time.
Because I know all these guys, and a lot of the answers you got would have been different answers if you would have had Eric and Bruce Perrin sitting next to each other. You would have gotten a lot different answers. But still a remarkable movie.
Well, thank you. Oh, one last thing I just want to tell people is that I get a lot of requests from people that like to screen the DVD for their Linux user group, and that is just fine by me. I'm happy for people to do that. All they have to do is just purchase a copy of the DVD and screen it, and if they want, send me a link or an email about the screening, and I will add it to the revolutionos.com website.
Okay.
That's great.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
There's one persistent question out on IRC, too, that I want to get to before people start sending us flaming emails.
Oh, okay.
And that is, why don't you distribute a copy of the NOPIX ISO on the DVD? I don't know if you're acquainted with NOPIX, but NOPIX is a type of Linux distribution that doesn't require installation. It just runs straight from the disk. It's an interesting way to introduce people to Linux. But we have several people who have been asking about that, including NZ Heretic and a couple others.
Well, I've got one other.
The practical issue is that we basically maxed out both DVDs, and having to throw out stuff to fit everything on two DVDs. And then the other thing is just that my concern was, because once we master the DVDs, this master hopefully will last us for a number of years. And so my concern with putting any sort of Linux distribution on there is that it would grow outdated very quickly.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is art. Art doesn't get old. Linux
you.
Distributions do.
Yeah, would have been nice to have Woody on there, wouldn't it, though? Well, I tell you, we are 20 minutes after the hour, so that is the end of the show. I'd like to thank you for coming by. It's been a really interesting segment.
Well, thank you so much, and if you ever would like to have me back, just let me know. It's been great.
Well, you know, hopefully, you'll do a reprise in like 5 years. Because this isn't a criticism, because, you know, documentaries, they're supposed to tell the truth, right? I mean, that's the whole idea. And unfortunately, the timing of the conclusion of the documentary timed at the moment in American history when the dot-com bust happened. And so a large number of the companies that you were talking about during the documentary did not survive, or they're significantly smaller than they were.
Had quite a reversal of fortune, shall
right.
I say.
Right. As did every other business.
That's right.
In the IT industry.
That's right.
And, you know, whether people are savvy enough to understand that this isn't a Linux thing, it's an IT thing, I don't know. But it would be interesting to see a reprise 5 or 10 years into the future of re-interviewing these same people and looking at the issue in, you know, 2005 or 2010, and looking at the economic position and see if a lot of us who are looking upon Linux's role as boards and nails, if to see if that really does come to fruit. So it'd be really interesting if you did a a reprise 5 or 10 years from now.
Oh, I totally agree, and if I had the opportunity, I would love to. The analogy I use is to think of the story of open source. Basically, Revolution OS is Star Wars. It ends at a certain point, but the story keeps going. We're kind of in the Empire Strikes Back phase now, to a certain extent. You know, especially if you consider what happened right around 2001 and whatnot. And in a year or so, we'll move into a new phase. And this phase is fascinating because this is a phase where basically big companies like, Richard Stallman's, and this is the reason the documentary ends the way it does, because I think there's something amazingly ironic about this. Basically, Richard Stallman's vision, his response to proprietary closed software and big companies and license agreements was to create GNU and free software. And the grand irony is you have IBM and Hewlett-Packard and Sun and Oracle basically pushing his vision. And I think that is a great kind of almost only in America type turnabout and play of events.
Yep. Warfare, be it military or industrial, warfare breeds strange bedfellows.
That's right.
And the warfare with Microsoft has bred some very strange bedfellows indeed. But once again, I was just saying, we are up to the end of the show. We've got to blow out of here. I'd like to thank you for coming, and on behalf of the entire crew here, Doc, Russ, Arnie, Kevin, and myself, this has been the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show for April the 8th, 2003. We will expect to see all of you back here next week, same time, 10 tell 10 friends. We'll be back. We're out of here.
Although I've never been to Rio, there's something saying to me, go. Cause there's a chance I just might find my big romance there, Rio de Janeiro. Tomorrow I may fly to Rio to find the love I need to know. Someone is waiting for me somewhere, and it could be Rio de Janeiro. My Brazilian, are you only one man waiting in a million? Is that I'm the earth, I'm so willing. I can't keep spending time, I need to find you now. Show me how to get to Rio. I need some space to just unwind. There is a real thing that is real, but with Rio, it's possibly a state of mind.